This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia evacuates its diplomatic staff from Kyiv amid mounting tensions over Moscow's recognition of two regions in eastern Ukraine as independent states. The U.S. Secretary of State cancels his planned meeting with the Russian foreign minister, accusing Moscow of beginning an invasion of Ukraine. Also ahead, Israel launches surface-to-surface missiles from the occupied Golan to target an area in southwestern Syria. Welcome to the program. We begin this hour with the latest on mounting tensions over Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin says Russia is open to direct dialogue and diplomatic solutions, but will not negotiate the security of its citizens. Putin says the interests of Russia are also non-negotiable. The crisis is already escalating to new levels following Moscow's recognition of Luhansk and Donetsk and its ratification of friendship treaties with the two self-proclaimed republics in eastern Ukraine. Moscow says the move is aimed at sending peacekeeping missions to those breakaway regions, but Western leaders keep warning that Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine. The Kremlin says it has no such plans and that it is evacuating its own diplomatic staff from Ukraine for safety reasons. The U.S. imposes new sanctions on Russia as Moscow orders troops into the two breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine.
We're implementing full blocking sanctions on two large Russian financial institutions, VEB and their military bank. We're implementing comprehensive sanctions on Russian sovereign debt. That means we've cut off Russia's government from Western financing. It can no longer raise money from the West and cannot trade in its new debt on our markets or European markets either. Starting tomorrow and continuing in the days ahead, we'll also impose sanctions on Russia's elites and their family members, as with sanctions.
Biden described the peacekeeping mission as the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. He also authorized the deployment of additional forces and equipment to the Baltic region. Biden said the West is united in defending Ukraine against what he called the Russian aggression. Separately, the White House said a possible summit between the U.S. and Russian presidents is now out of the plans. The American Secretary of State has likewise canceled a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Meanwhile, Ukraine is considering severing diplomatic ties with Russia. The country has also drafted reservists, despite ruling out a general mobilization.
There is no need for the general mobilization today. We need to bring up to full strength the Ukrainian army and other military units in a speedy fashion. As Commander General of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, I issued a decree to recruit reservists during a special period.
Zelensky accused Russia of preparing for military aggression but played down prospects of a large-scale conflict. He called on his Western allies to quickly impose sanctions on Moscow. The West has already imposed a raft of sanctions on Russia, and the most significant of such measures, Berlin, has frozen the multi-billion dollar Nord Stream 2 pipeline project, which is to carry Russian natural gas to Germany. EU foreign ministers have also unanimously agreed on, quote, an initial sanctions package against Moscow. The Russian foreign ministry has slammed the West's sanctions as illegitimate. Iran, meanwhile, has called on all sides to exercise restraint, warning against any measures that could further escalate tensions. The European Union agrees on a new package of sanctions against Russian politicians, business operators, and media outlets over moves by Moscow to grant independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from the EU's de facto capital, Brussels.
EU foreign affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Israeli military has once again carried out a missile strike against Syria. Earlier, our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us to give us the details.
An official military source here in Syria confirmed that there has been an attack and said that about 12:30 a.m. local time, the Israeli enemy, and I quote, carried out an aggression, launching a number of surface-to-surface missiles from the direction of the occupied Syrian Golan and targeting some military points for the Syrian army in the vicinity of Al-Quneitra in the southern part of Syria. And this attack led to caused some material damage. Now, this is the third Israeli attack just this month. The previous ones targeted the vicinity of Damascus. Definitely, this is not a surprise for the Syrian army or the Syrian government, because this has been happening since the start of the crisis. And almost every time there's an attack, Syria makes sure to send letters to the United Nations to inform them and stress that such attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorist groups in Syria, because those attacks aim to undermine the Syrian army's capabilities in fighting terrorism on the ground. So definitely this is not a surprise. Definitely Syria always stressed that this is, of course, this undermines Syria's sovereignty. It is against international law and the UN Charter. However, we still see international silence over repeated Israeli attacks.
The Israeli killing of a teenager in the occupied West Bank is causing outrage across the Palestinian territories and evoking strong reactions from resistance movements. The Islamic Jihad movement said the killing in cold blood of the Palestinian boy is an obvious embodiment of terrorism and aggression against the defenseless people of Palestine. Hamas also says the killing is an indication of the regime's brutality against innocent people. 14-year-old Muhammad Shahad was fatally shot in the town of Al-Khadr near Bethlehem on Tuesday. It happened during a confrontation between a number of Palestinian youth and the Israeli soldiers who were conducting a raid in the area. Palestinian media say Muhammad was denied immediate medical care after being shot. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have marched to drum up support for Al-Quds as they mark the 53rd anniversary of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Ashraf Shannon is in Gaza.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalized their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's top diplomat says it is now the turn of the Western participants in the Vienna talks to show initiative and flexibility.
So far, we've taken lots of initiatives and shown the required flexibility at the Vienna negotiating table. If today we're saying we're closer than ever to a deal, it's because we've informed the Americans via intermediaries, and three European countries have been told by my colleagues in Vienna or by myself through telephone conversations or during meetings with foreign ministers of these three countries. We're saying very clearly to them that now it's your turn. It's time to see initiatives and flexibility from the Western side.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said a final deal can be reached in a matter of hours if the Western side adopts a realistic approach. He said Tehran will continue to negotiate in earnest with the aim of achieving a good agreement. Amir Abdullahian criticized France, Germany, and the United Kingdom for failing to honor their commitments under the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. He also questioned Washington's claim of showing goodwill towards Iran as it continues to hit the country with sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran's top security official says the country's peaceful nuclear program must continue to act as, quote, the sword of Damocles against countries that break their promises. Ali Shamkhani said the program will be a real and inherent guarantee that those countries honor their commitments. In other news, three white men convicted of shooting and murdering a young African-American man in 2020 have been found guilty of federal hate crimes. The defendants are found guilty of attempted kidnapping of Ahmed Arbery and violating his civil rights by attacking him because of his race. The trio is also convicted of a federal firearms charge. The three men were convicted last year in state court and sentenced to life terms for murdering Arbery as he was out jogging in Georgia. Now, despite convictions, Arbery's mother still carries anger toward the Department of Justice for attempting a plea deal with his son's murderers.
That's not justice for Ahmaud. Oh, what we got today, we wouldn't have gotten today if it wasn't for the fight that the family put up on January the 31st. What the DOJ did today, they was made to do today.
Come on.
It wasn't because what they wanted to do. They were made to do their job today.
Arbery's mother was referring to the Justice Department's decision to accept the plea deal in late January. In a separate case, a federal prosecutor has said the police officers present during the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020 ignored their training in basic human decency. The prosecutor says they should have intervened when their colleague knelt on Floyd's neck during the deadly arrest. Rishi Sunak, Britain's finance minister, is the man attempting to lead the country out of the worst squeeze on households in three decades. Alongside Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, Sunak has been touted as a potential successor to under-fire Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But just what are his odds? Amina Taylor is in the British capital.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
He's one of the most powerful British politicians. Rishi Sunak, the minister tasked with forging a fiscal plan that will get the UK back on its economic feet after a rocky period of trying to navigate global market dips, international conflict, COVID, and Brexit. He's also regarded by some as the man waiting in the wings should Boris Johnson's numerous political missteps eventually catch up with him. Sunak, the son of East African Indian immigrants, has had a meteoric rise to high office since becoming an MP in 2015. Turmoil within Tory ranks might have helped, but Sunak has been one of the few leaders to have positive polling numbers post-lockdown.
Despite Rishi Sunak's conservative credentials, he's after all pro-market, pro-business, and publicly at least seems to be supporting the Brexit project. There are question marks about whether the majority of his colleagues inside the House behind me and the wider Tory party faithful will see the credentials and not just stop at the ethnicity.
It's not simply the lack of any public brand of political ideology or vision that's also hampered Sunak. It's the attention on his wealth. A banker and hedge fund manager before entering politics, his wife alone has some £430 million in shares from the family business, technically making her richer than Britain's Queen Elizabeth. As the political games play out behind the scenes to maneuver a candidate as Johnson's heir apparent, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss supporters hope their choice will go all the way. But as any serious observer of British politics knows, the ultimate winner is usually the late comer no one saw coming. Amina Taylor, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Limelight. Artificial intelligence has been identified as one of the top three emerging technologies in conservation, helping protect species around the world. We now present you an article written by Graham Greene. The piece is titled Five Ways Artificial Intelligence is Saving Wildlife, from counting chimps to locating whales. There's a strand of thinking, from sci-fi films to Stephen Hawking, that suggests artificial intelligence could spell doom for humans. But conservationists are increasingly turning to artificial intelligence as an innovative technology solution to tackle the biodiversity crisis and mitigate climate change. A recent report by WildLabs.net found that artificial intelligence was one of the top three emerging technologies in conservation. From camera trap and satellite images to audio recordings, the report notes, artificial intelligence can learn how to identify which photographs out of thousands contain rare species, or pinpoint an animal call out of hours of field recordings, hugely reducing the manual labor required to collect vital conservation data. Artificial intelligence is helping to protect species as diverse as humpback whales, koalas, and snow leopards, supporting the work of scientists, researchers, and rangers in vital tasks, from anti-poaching patrols to monitoring species. With machine learning, computer systems that use algorithms and models to learn, understand, and adapt, artificial intelligence is often able to do the job of hundreds of people, getting faster, cheaper, and more effective results. Here are five artificial intelligence projects contributing to our understanding of biodiversity and species. 1. Stopping poachers. Zambia's Kafue National Park is home to more than 6,600 African savanna elephants and covers 22,400 square kilometers, so stopping poaching is a big logistical challenge. Illegal fishing in Lake Itezitezi on the park's border is also a problem, and poachers masquerade as fishers to enter and exit the park undetected, often under the cover of darkness. The Connected Conservation Initiative from Game Rangers International, Zambia's Department of National Parks and Wildlife and other partners is also using artificial intelligence to enhance conventional anti-poaching efforts, creating a 19-kilometer-long virtual fence across Lake Itsejitezi. Forward-looking infrared thermal cameras record every boat crossing in and out of the park day and night. Installed in 2019, the cameras were monitored manually by rangers, who could then respond to signs of illegal activity. Forward-looking infrared artificial intelligence has now been trained to automatically detect boats entering the park, increasing the effectiveness and reducing the need for constant manual surveillance. Waves and flying birds can also trigger alerts, so the artificial intelligence is being taught to eliminate these false readings. Ian Hode, Special Technical Advisor at Game Rangers International, says there have long been insufficient resources to secure protected areas, and having people watch multiple cameras 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, doesn't scale. Artificial intelligence can be a game changer, as it can monitor for illegal boat crossings and alert ranger teams immediately. The technology has enabled a handful of rangers to provide around-the-clock surveillance of a massive illegal entry point across Lake Itsejitezi. Two, tracking water loss. Brazil has lost more than 15% of its surface water in the past 30 years, a crisis that has only come to light with the help of artificial intelligence. The country's rivers, lakes, and wetlands have been facing increasing pressure from a growing population, economic development, deforestation, and the worsening effects of the climate crisis. But no one knew the scale of the problem until last August, when, using machine learning, the MAP Biomass Water Project released its results after processing more than 150,000 images generated by NASA's Landsat 5, 7, and 8 satellites from 1985 to 2020 across the 8.5 million square kilometer of Brazilian territory. Without artificial intelligence, researchers could not have analyzed water changes across the country at the scale and level of detailed needed. Artificial intelligence can also distinguish between natural and human-created water bodies. The Negro River, a major tributary of the Amazon River and one of the world's 10 largest rivers by volume, has lost 22% of its surface water. The Brazilian portion of the Pantanal, the world's largest tropical wetland, has lost 74% of its surface water. Such losses are devastating for wildlife. 4,000 species of plants and animals live in the Pantanal, including jaguars, tapirs, and anacondas. People and nature. Cassio Bernardino, World Wildlife Fund, Brazil's Biomass Water Project lead, says, "Artificial intelligence technology provided us with a shockingly clear picture. Without artificial intelligence and machine learning technology, we would never have known how serious the situation was, let alone had the data to convince people. Now we can take steps to tackle the challenges this loss of surface water poses to Brazil's incredible biodiversity and communities." Number 3. Finding whales. Knowing where whales are is the first step in putting measures such as marine protected areas in place to protect them. Locating humpback whales visually across vast oceans is difficult, but their distinctive singing can travel hundreds of miles underwater. At National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association fisheries in the Pacific Islands, acoustic recorders are used to monitor marine mammal populations at remote and hard-to-access islands. Anne Allen, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association research oceanographer, says, "In 14 years, we've accumulated around 190,000 hours of acoustic recordings. It would take an exorbitant amount of time for an individual to manually identify whale vocalizations." In 2018, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, NOAA, partnered with Google Artificial Intelligence for Social Good's bioacoustics team to create a machine learning model that could recognize humpback whale songs. Four, protecting koalas. Australia's koala populations are in serious decline due to habitat destruction, domestic dog attacks, road accidents and bushfires. Without knowledge of their numbers and whereabouts, saving them is challenging. Grant Hamilton, Associate Professor of Ecology at Queensland University of Technology in Australia, has created a conservation artificial intelligence hub with Federal and Landcare Australia funding to count koalas and other endangered animals. Using drones and infrared imaging, an artificial intelligence algorithm rapidly analyzes infrared footage and determines whether a heat signature is a koala or another animal. Grant Hamilton used the system after Australia's devastating bushfires in 2019 and 2020 to identify surviving koala populations, particularly on Kangaroo Island. Grant Hamilton says, "This is a game-changer project to protect koalas. Powerful artificial intelligence algorithms are able to analyze countless hours of video footage and identify koalas from many other animals in the thick bushland. The system will allow land care groups, conservation groups, and organizations working on protecting and monitoring species to survey large areas anywhere in Australia and send the data back to us at the Queensland University of Technology to process it." Number 5. Counting species. Saving species on the brink of extinction in the Congo Basin, the world's second largest rainforest, is a huge task. In 2020, data science company Apsilon teamed up with the University of Stirling in Scotland and Gabon's National Parks Agency to develop the Mambaza artificial intelligence image classification algorithm for large-scale biodiversity monitoring in Gabon's Lopé and Waka national parks. Conservationists had been using automated cameras to capture species including African forest elephants, gorillas, chimpanzees and pangolins, which then had to be manually identified. Millions of pictures could take months or years to classify, and in a country that is losing about 150 elephants each month to poachers, time matters. The Mabaza artificial intelligence algorithm was used in 2020 to analyze more than 50,000 images collected from 200 camera traps spread across 7,000 square kilometers of forest. Mabaza artificial intelligence classifies up to 3,000 images an hour and is up to 96% accurate. Conservationists can monitor and track animals and quickly spot anomalies or warning signs, enabling them to act swiftly when needed. The algorithm also works offline on an ordinary laptop, which is helpful in locations with no or poor internet connectivity.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Hezbollah had been vanquished. That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war. How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 3.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war, one of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. The World Cup opening match was held between Argentina and Belgium. On that day, the Lebanese capital Beirut was under attack by Israeli fighter jets and tanks that had the city under siege.
The Beirut siege happened during the World Cup, where two Arab nations, Kuwait and Algeria, were present.
Polemico del Mondiale spagnolo, il 2 si ebbe quando la Francia aveva del consiglio di Carlos Alberto. Posso con due reti di vantaggio segnate da Jean Guin.
Algeria beat Germany, and Kuwait Football Federation chief Fahad al-Ahmad al-Sabah halted the Kuwait-France match to protest France's fourth goal. He fought for 7 minutes, and the referee was forced to annul the goal.
Tuttavia non era partito dal fischietto dell'arbitro sovietico, ma evidentemente.
As Israelis stepped up their bombing campaign, battle intensified. We thought Beirut burning under fire would shock the world, that the world will react to landing of a mortar, Al Burj Al Barajna building in the city, and the deaths of at least 75 innocent humans. We witnessed rallies in Algeria, but we later realized that they were just cheering for Algeria's victory against Germany in the World Cup.
Demonstrations were held across the Arab world because they thought Algeria's elimination from the World Cup had been a fix. But no one took to the street for the occupation of the second Arab capital after Al-Quds. Before the establishment of Hezbollah, Lebanon had seen several conflicts with Israel. There were two kinds of wars. Firstly, the partisan and army battles where national and Palestinian resistance groups were involved. And secondly, the battle fought by the Syrian army in the 1982 Lebanon-Israel conflict. In 1982, Israeli forces were double the combined number of troops Syria and Egypt had deployed in the October 1973 war. But Israel faced two different forms of resistance, military and non-military, in Lebanon. But how did Israel achieve victory against them? The natural elements of the Lebanese battlefield and its complex geography with its heights and narrow passes through the mountains left Israel no option but to employ new tactics. The strategy relied on heavy use of infantry and greater use of units than Israel dispatched for the 1973 war, but across a smaller area of only 70 kilometers. Israel used the maximum number of troops possible to take control of main crossways and sensitive points, overlooking key towns and cities, while taking hold of key geographical locations. To be able to reorganize its forces, Israel wanted a second portion of its troops to quickly advance towards Beirut, while the first groups had resistance forces encircled. The second group was to be supported by special forces, who would provide them with their needed equipment deep in Lebanese territory through marine or air transport methods. However, the Israeli army faced a demographic factor, a major geostrategic element in the war. They didn't have the needed experience to fight in urban and residential areas. Classic armies naturally avoid entering populated areas to prevent troop casualties, since such areas are full of buildings that limit movement. The Israeli forces were built upon heavy armored units supported by infantry, but Tel Aviv had not improved its infantry tactics, despite the fact that its troops had to fight face-to-face battles against popular resistance forces to be able to encircle them. The low number of Israeli infantry units gave the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance groups the opportunity of free movement and of engaging Israeli forces, though they failed to use the existing opportunity. The Lebanese National Resistance Front and the Palestinian Resistance Forces retreated as the classic Israeli army advanced into Lebanon, that was done in accordance with non-military principles without undermining their policy of confrontation. This is what Chinese leader and one of the most significant guerrilla war theorists, Mao Zedong, used to say. He said, "Escape when an army attacks you, confront it when it settles down, and follow it when it retreats."
Yasser Arafat used his entire experience of guerrilla wars. He had access to the experience of a full range of resistance movements, including those from Russia and Algeria, as well as weapons from across the globe. The Japanese also helped him along with their Red Army, German guerrilla group Badr-Menov Group, and Italy's Red Brigades. All of them sympathized with the Palestinian issue, as they had Arab countries' facilities at their disposal, and even had interests in the Arab oil industry. The Palestinian resistance staged a hard-fought partisan battle since the very establishment of the Zionist regime. The battle had a history of ups and downs, both in Palestine and outside, including in Jordan and Lebanon. Therefore, it was not a domestic guerrilla war, and there is no partisan battle except that it gains victory. This is a historically recognized fact based on the experience of the wars of the past.
On October 6th, the Israeli army, equipped with large numbers of Merkava tanks, launched a pitched battle against Lebanon. Israeli forces began advancing along several axes with a focus on the coastal areas. One of the most important classic battles of the 1982 war took place here in this place, where Israeli and Syrian armies engaged in the Battle of Sultan Yaqub. During the battle, Syrian army forces inflicted heavy damage on Israeli armored personnel carriers that stopped them from advancing. In just 5 days, the Israelis managed to extend their domination to two-thirds of Lebanon. That was when they realized the road to Beirut was all clear. They were finally within kilometers of the Lebanese capital on June 9. On that day, Lebanon witnessed one of the heaviest air battles in modern times.
كان البقاع ولا يزال جزءا من النطاق الأمني السوري إلى دمشق وسوريا.
Beqaa has always been part of Syria's security margin for Damascus. Therefore, Syria has to keep its security presence at the border town to make up for Lebanon's weak border security in the valley. If not, Israelis could use the Beqaa area to enter Lebanon, while military forces in Bilad al-Sham, Greater Syria, which is 30 kilometers away from Beqaa, could not defend the area. Therefore, Syria had to set up its defenses from outside of Bilad al-Sham and deployed its SAM-6 anti-air defense system to Lebanon to that end. The key issue here is that back in 1982, the Israeli enemies wanted both to get rid of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and prevent Arabs, especially Syrians, from repeating the victories they gained during the 1973 war. Arabs could reduce Israel's air superiority through creation of a semi-active air defense system, providing more ease of movement to Syrian and Egyptian forces. The advantage cost Israelis part of their air force and surprised them for a short period of time, providing the Arab side of the war with a sort of a victory. In fact, all of that was an achievement of the air defense systems of Egypt and Syria, especially the latter's, as Syrian soldiers used the air defense system with ultimate skill.
In June 1982, the Israelis resorted to destroying missile systems in an attempt to prevent limited successes of the Arabs in the October War. After the destruction of the air defense systems, Syrians deployed 100 aircraft to counter the Israelis' air assaults. The Israelis responded with ambushing the Syrian fighter jets. One of such tactics was the use of F-16 aircraft able to tackle air-to-air missiles of Syria's MiG-23 fighter jets, leading to the destruction of a large number of Syrian jets, up to 36 of them.
In 1982, the Syrian army faced a large-scale attack that led to many deaths. they forced Syria out of southern Beirut and the Jabal area and besieged Syrian forces in Beqa. They pushed the large Syrian contingent out of southern Beirut. The 85th Brigade left Beirut with its flag lowered due to a planned peace agreement. On the fifth day of the war, Israel ended the battle with Syria, setting the stage for talks.
This was the climax of the Israeli military doctrine's achievements. The doctrine proved to itself and to the world that it is effective and successful both against popular resistance movements and military tactics of classic armies, as it overcame both classic and non-classic methods of battle on Lebanese soil.
Palestinian resistance groups also did their best, including by volunteer operations, aircraft hijacking, and domestic operations, but they led nowhere.
Only then did a man emerge before the eyes of the world who said Israel had been trapped. Ruhollah. And at his hands and under his supervision, we were told of the auspicious birth of a unique form of fighting, comprised of the three elements of faith, jihad, and martyrdom, so that it sets out a new direction, which Ruhollah dubbed Hezbollah. The party of Allah, they will be predominant. And only a few years later, Yitzhak Shamir told the world that Hezbollah are only a different sort of Arabs.
The creation of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon shook the pillars of Israel's security doctrine. The Islamic resistance adopted a special method in the battle against the Israeli forces, which were defeated neither by classic armies nor in non-military battles. Hezbollah put up an unprecedented fight in the history of military science and overcame Israelis. The victory had nothing to do with the geographic elements, as the Palestinian resistance battled Israelis in the same environment. It was not also because Hezbollah was a Lebanese movement, as even the Lebanese and their popular movements fought Israel with the same weapons and on the same lands, but failed to defeat Israel. It was not the territory that gave Hezbollah the upper hand. As Palestinians engaged Israelis in the same territory, so did the Lebanese. Then what made the difference?
Tactic is the element that puts different forms of knowledge at the service of a battle. The more skillful and capable a commander, the fresher and more creative his military tactics would be. It means a capable commander's exceptional leadership and war plans are the results of defining the principles and rules of battle in a specific way. These two factors are in turn rooted in the commander's perception of the principles of war and his detailed assessment of the facts on the ground in the battlefield. The rules of battle can be both firm and flexible. Did Hezbollah develop a special tactic during its years of resistance? Is Hezbollah now in possession of a new technology they have adapted to the battlefield?
In theory, tactic is the knowledge of capabilities, technologies, and details. But in practice, tactic is the ability to create a link between creativity, flexibility, and moderate decision-making in the difficult conditions of the battlefield against a shrewd enemy, coupled with the commander's understanding of the human nature and the impact of the war on his soldiers. Therefore, when we say resistance shattered the enemy on the battlefield, it means the enemy was defeated on the three tactical, practical, and strategic levels. That was what led to the shattering of the enemy's national security doctrine.
Over the years, Hezbollah has been fighting Israel. The resistance developed a military concept of its own. Therefore, what it laid out in southern Lebanon was different from its entire experience of the past.
ما شهدناه في العام 2000 تحديدا من أداء لجنود ونخب العدو.
What we saw in the year 2000 was that enemy soldiers, its special forces and officers, as well as their whole military establishment, were present in Lebanon. However, none of them could give the slightest response to the operation by the resistance, which demonstrates any operation planned by the movement leads to victory, and nothing can be done to counter or stop it. This was the conclusion that led the enemy to retreat.
Israel was twice taken by surprise by Hezbollah. First, by Hezbollah's preparedness for war, and second, by its realization that what it accomplished in the past and the powerful means it used to make those accomplishments were no longer effective against such a well-prepared opponent. The July battle was different from all the past battles Israel had fought since its establishment. Military history proved the superiority of Hezbollah over Israel's military doctrine, which had earlier proved itself effective against the Arabs' both classic and non-classic warfare. Israel faced a new form of resistance, which was fledging back in 1982 and hit its climax in July 2006.
Some say the enemy was on the defensive before the year 2000. However, if we assume that invasion is the key decisive advantages in a war, it was Israel that had the advantage in 2006, as it was Israel that made the assault. We witnessed terrible scenes during the war. The enemy's performance was extremely poor. Researchers said the poor performance was rooted in Israel's failure to balance its forces and its reservists, as well as numerous other problems that made the true reasons behind Israel's failure. But the real reason for its defeat was the performance of enemy's soldiers and officers. Israel's military doctrine failed both in strategic and practical terms, while the failure was also visible in the different aspects of its military concepts and structures. Israeli military organization, soldiers, and officers were also unable to find appropriate methods to fight Hezbollah on the battlefield. But the more significant issue was the resistance movement's superiority to Israel in terms of its military doctrine, theory of the battle, and all strategic, practical, and tactical dimensions.
Limelight. While many assume that they will be immune after catching COVID, experts say the emergence of Omicron variant has seen a significant increase in reinfection. We now present you an article written by Caitlin Cassidy. The piece is titled, What the Hell? The Unlucky Australians Who Have Caught COVID Twice. Peter Coleman took a rapid antigen test just weeks after recovering from COVID-19. It was partially for the fun of it. Peter first tested positive for the virus on 10th of January, during the post-holiday period that saw a spike in cases hit Melbourne, Australia, and elsewhere. He says, I was feeling really unwell, but I didn't expect to be positive. I thought I'd just double check. He adds, I was on the phone with my friend after I took the test, and then I looked over and I was just like, I have to go, like, what the hell? Peter is one of the unlucky Australians to have been reinfected with COVID-19 after making a full or partial recovery from the virus. No data on COVID-19 reinfections is currently being collated by the federal government, but a spokesperson for the Department of Health says the emergence of the Omicron variant has seen a significant increase in the risk of reinfection compared with previous variants. The spokesperson says there is increasing evidence that there is little cross-neutralization with Omicron variant. Whether Omicron infection protects against another Omicron infection is unclear, and there remains significant uncertainty about the durability of immunity following infection with the emergence of Omicron. When Peter first acquired the virus, he was hit by brain fog so bad he forgot how to order food on Uber Eats, along with muscle aches and fatigue. The second time, though, symptoms were very different, more akin to a common cold or flu. Peter, who works from home, says he had no idea where he acquired the second infection, only that it happened just outside the 30-day period when he initially tested positive. Fully vaccinated, Peter expects he had been hit by the Omicron strain, but has no way to know for sure. Peter says the second bout was relatively minor. When a nurse rang to check on him, she asked if he was feeling depressed. I said, not depressed, but unimpressed. The Communicable Disease Network Australia continues to